You're listening to a Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders 30th Anniversary Podcast. Founded in 1978, GLAAD is New England's leading legal rights organization dedicated to ending discrimination based on sexual orientation, HIV status, and gender identity and expression. For more information and updates on GLAAD's current legal work, visit us at glaad.org.
Dade County, Florida, 1977.
Newsmen were questioning Miss Bryant about her national crusade against gay persons when four self-proclaimed homosexuals from Minneapolis interrupted today's proceedings.
If we were going to go on a crusade across the nation and try to do away with the homosexuals, then we certainly would have done it on June the 8th after one of the most overwhelming victories in the country. But we didn't. We tried to avoid it and went into a place called Norfolk, Virginia, and were met with protest and all kinds of problems. And
And that's when one of the gay men, posing as a reporter, hit Anita Bryant in the face with a banana cream pie. At least, said Bryant through a layer of custard, it was a fruit pie. Bryant was the face of the anti-gay backlash in the 1970s. A singer, former Miss Oklahoma, and the spokesperson for Florida Orange Juice, she used her minor celebrity to fuel a national campaign against equal rights for gay men and lesbians. She called her cause Save Our Children, linking homosexuality with child abuse to gain public support for an anti-gay agenda. Bryant's first target was a Dade County ordinance protecting gays and lesbians from discrimination. She succeeded, and in June 1977, voters overturned the anti-discrimination law. Soon after, Florida legislators passed another law, banning adoptions by gay and lesbian parents. Bryant's message spread. Seeing their chance to gain political ground, conservative groups passed anti-gay ballot measures throughout the country. But something else happened. Outraged by the Florida defeat and by Bryant's characterizations of the gay community, gay men and lesbians throughout the country came out, came together, and organized in new ways, with new strength. GLAAD, Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, came from that strength. In Boston, in 1977 and 1978, District Attorney Garrett Byrne played on similar fears about children to target the gay community, specifically gay men. Then, in his seventh term as Suffolk County DA and up for re-election, Byrne had a history of targeting minority communities, many thought to boost his own political career. Byrne cracked down after a series of arrests in 1977, in which 24 men were indicted for having sexual relationships with underage boys. His office set up a hotline, asking the public to call in with anonymous tips about suspicious interactions between men and boys. There were two openly gay lawyers in Boston at the time, Catherine Triantafilou, a known lesbian lawyer, and a young gay lawyer named John Ward. Ward talked about those days at a 1988 event for GLAAD's 10th anniversary.
10 years is a long time in terms of facts and law in Boston. It's really a very different scene. There weren't many of us doing this activist crazy stuff. 10 years ago, Catherine was doing it before I was, but not for too long. And I was really the first man that got into it. And now it's a very different scene.
But in 1978, Ward was a local pioneer. Just 2 years out of law school, he set up a law practice at 2 Park Square in Boston, hung out a shingle, and put an ad in Gay Community News, a Boston newspaper then considered the most influential gay paper in the country. In those days, an ad by a gay lawyer, even in a gay newspaper, was something. Otherwise, finding a sympathetic lawyer was a matter of knowing the right people and hearing the right rumors. John Ward explains.
Before I came along, you know, there was, I mean, Catherine was known, but otherwise, if you wanted somebody else, it was sort of a word-of-mouth grapevine. You know, well, I hear that so-and-so, you know, is gay and does these cases. Gay lawyers were not exactly a dime a dozen in those days, and so I quickly obtained a lot of, I don't know if the word is notoriety or reputation or whatever, but people got to know pretty quickly that I was around.
Ward says it was an exciting time, daunting in some ways for an out gay lawyer, but full of possibilities. Ward was busy in his private practice doing everything from wills to immigration, mostly for gay clients. He also started working with a group called the Boston Boise Committee. Boston Boise was a group of local gay and lesbian activists who organized against anti-gay initiatives like Burns Hotline. The committee got its name from similar attacks on gay rights in Boise, Idaho in 1955, described in John Jurassic's book, The Boys of Boise. Boston Boise hired Ward to file for an injunction against the hotline. The night before he and lawyer Michael Avery went to court to get the injunction, Ward got a call from Burns' second-in-command, Assistant District Attorney John Gaffney.
Garrett Byrne was sort of in his dotage at this time, and this guy, whose name was Gaffney, was sort of the guy that ran things. So he called me, what's all this about? And I said, well, it's, you know, we're looking for this injunction. Well, this is just crazy. I said, well, I guess I'll see you in court. He said, okay, honey. So that was sort of how it was. And I was just out of law school and quite terrified by all this, but a colleague of mine went with me to court. And afterwards, he ran into Gaffney in the elevator, and Gaffney says to him, so I saw you were with that John Ward, and he's, you know, light on his feet. Are you that way too? And so Mike Avery says to him, well, John, I really wouldn't tell you, it's private, but I can tell you that if I were gay, I wouldn't go out with district attorneys.
It turned out Ward didn't have to fight hard for the injunction. Anticipating a loss in court, Burns' office announced they were shutting down the hotline. It was an important win, but for Ward, that wasn't the committee's biggest success. Here he is again in 1988.
The thing that was of most interest to me in the Boston Boise Committee was what was really a unique ability of this event and the people who organized around that committee to bring together people that ordinarily don't speak to each other, you know, and so at least for a brief moment, there was a willingness on the part of all kinds of people to take a stand for the civil rights of the men involved, at least a common willingness to say, look, you know, there are such things as fair trial rights and due process rights and the rules of evidence and witch hunt and all sorts of things like that. And as a lawyer, that appealed to me. And as a person who is not comfortable in an arena dominated by a heavy political agenda, it was also very comfortable. I was looking for commonality rather than reasons to disagree. And so I was fascinated by the energy that I experienced at these demonstrations, which were wonderful demonstrations. And for those of you that missed them, I'm really sorry. You missed some great.
These demonstrations, what showed Ward the real energy and potential in Boston's gay community, were the protests at the Boston Public Library in 1978. Responding to what they said were citizen complaints about men soliciting sex in the library bathroom, the Boston Police Department in early 1978 stepped up their surveillance. They assigned plainclothes police officers to the detail, and in March started aggressively targeting gay patrons. One cop, usually a young officer named Angelo Terizzi, would work the bathroom, and once he found a prospect, he'd signal to another cop waiting outside. Then they'd make the arrest. In other words, entrapment. John Ward.
They found a cute young cop, and they sent him in to stand at, you know, one of the urinals and play with himself. And if somebody exhibited interest, they had cops waiting outside, and Angelo Terizzi would give them a hand signal or some sort of signal. I don't know, one of his hands was busy, I suppose, but, you know, he somehow managed to communicate that this person got the nod, and then when the person left the bathroom, they would be arrested and charged with open and gross lewdness, which is a felony. And, you know, I mean, people would freak out because a lot of the people that were caught up in that were married or closeted or, you know, and typically what people had done in the past was they would plead guilty, you know, and get some sort of fine.
103 men were arrested at the library within 2 weeks that March. Charges included indecent exposure, prostitution, and open and gross lewdness, a felony in Massachusetts. A felony charge added to the shame and embarrassment of a public sex arrest and had long-term consequences, since felony arrests can be used to exclude a person from some professions, and local police share felony arrest records with the FBI. Typically, Ward says, men arrested for public sex had been too ashamed to go to court. They'd plead guilty and pay a fine. But this time was different. Gay Community News reported that only 35 of the 103 defendants pled guilty. Ward was among the lawyers who helped the others fight back, and he realized he could win.
What I realized was that, you know, unfortunately, oftentimes police officers don't tell the entire truth about what happens. And at the same time, since they had no experience being opposed, they weren't really good at making a coherent story. So I saw that it was possible to get people found not guilty. So I began to fight these cases.
In fact, according to a Gay Community News story on March 25th, 1978, Officer Terizzi's statement of facts was the same for each defendant arraigned to that date, about half of all the men arrested, even though the defendants themselves gave very different accounts. And according to a later GCN article, Terizzi one day in court seemed to confuse a blonde, blue-eyed law student with an African-American man he'd arrested at the library. The arrest pointed to an underlying police attitude that at best disregarded, and at worst, actively violated gay men's civil rights. As Boston Police Captain James McDonald told GCN that March, "I believe in gay rights, but they don't extend to public restrooms." But rather than weaken the gay community, the arrests prompted gays and lesbians to act and organize in ways they never had. Led by members of Boston Boise, the community quickly planned a protest. On April 1, 1978, about 200 supporters demonstrated on the library steps. They carried signs: Bryant, Byrne, and the BPL, the sick, the bad, the ugly, dump the DA, and gays pay taxes too. One man, dressed as a skeleton, and held a sign that read, "RIP Gay Rights." Some marchers burned their library cards. And as Boston's gay community rallied, John Ward saw a new possibility for justice. Ward says the 1978 library protests were the impetus for starting GLAAD. He wanted to harness the new energy he saw, to give it a new direction and purpose that would have an impact on the law. Ward was GLAAD's first executive director. His board of directors were activists he knew from the movement. Among them were Charlie Shively from FagRag, lawyer Mike Avery, Richard Burns from Gay Community News, Ed Hohen, pastor of the Metropolitan Community Church in Boston, Holly Ladd from the National Lawyers Guild, Ward's former law partner, attorney Cindy Rizzo, and Kathy Travers, who herself later would become an executive director at GLAAD. To make it official, Don Shuey, Ward's boyfriend at the time, typed up an application for 501c3 status, the federal tax-exempt status for nonprofit organizations. He mailed it to Washington, and he waited.
And it took some doing to get the 501c3 status because our purpose was to espouse lesbian and gay rights and all that sort of thing. And the indications weren't real good that we were going to get it. And I was about to go to federal court, but I called the office down there in Washington, and I guess I got a guy on the phone. I think he probably was gay, because he said to me, "Well, you know, you can go to federal court, but why don't you leave it with me for a couple of weeks?" And magically, it got approved.
Next, GLAAD needed money. Ward says fundraising wasn't his strength, but he had a volunteer, a Harvard law student named Jose Gomez, who had worked with Cesar Chavez and knew how to organize and motivate people. Jose would sit for hours in the conference room of Ward's office at 2 Park Square, calling through a list of names he kept on index cards, getting people to write checks. In the early days, Ward says, that's how he kept the door open. Here he is again in 1988.
We also had a stage name called Park Square Advocates, because there were a lot of people that couldn't write checks, you know, that had the word gay in it, you know, and so we gave them this other name, Park Square Advocates. I guess we addressed the Internal Revenue Service as Park Square Advocates rather than, you know, gay and lesbian advocates and vendors. So the vision, if anything, was that occasionally you can get a lot of bang for your buck out of law, you know, because once you get sort of elevated into the system, you know, you're published in the official reports and all these people, you know, they get into blah blah discourse with you, and you know, you can get some publicity, and it's a good, the law, at, you know, is often a good educative tool. You know, you get issues cared and so forth. And at the beginning, that's certainly all we could do. You know, it was a big deal. I mean, the first case that we filed in amicus brief then was the Macaulay versus the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination. And it was the first time that anything had ever been, you know, presented to the Supreme Judicial Court with the word gay on it, you know, outside of quotation marks. And it was an amicus brief, you know, prepared by us and signed Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders.
In the beginning, Ward says his private practice and GLAAD were almost indistinguishable. If a new case seemed like it had a compelling public interest element, he'd call it a GLAAD case. And most times, he wouldn't charge for it. It wasn't about money, he says. It was about the movement. Ward kept working on cases that came from the library arrests. Only one of the 103 library defendants was found guilty, and that conviction was later overturned. But Boston police and the FBI still had the photographs and fingerprints of those with felony arrests. Ward worked to expunge the records kept on file for each defendant. And in 1979, in GLAAD's first case, Ward filed a civil suit on behalf of a man arrested at the library and eventually found not guilty. Gay Community News reported that the man, identified only as John Doe, was at the library for a concert when Angelo Terizzi propositioned him. Doe said no. Terizzi persisted, and Doe finally agreed. Terizzi arrested him for prostitution, later testifying that Doe had offered him $20 for oral sex. Doe was found not guilty in Boston Municipal Court, and with GLAAD's help, went ahead with the civil suit. The case, Doe v. McNiff, charged police officials and the Boston Public Library, headed at the time by Philip McNiff, with violating his rights under Massachusetts law and under the 1st, 4th, and 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution. The case finally went to trial in 1980 and was settled 8 years later. The significance of the BPL arrests in GLAAD's history is less about the legal case than about how the arrests galvanized the community. They gave the fight for equal rights and justice new strength and focus. As John Ward wrote in GLAAD's first newsletter in the fall of 1979,
"The courtroom battles for gay rights have entered a new phase as a growing number of gay public interest law firms are representing the gay community. The courts are now hearing us in our own voices, and we are presenting vigorous defenses in our own cases."
In the coming months, as GLAAD celebrates 3 decades of groundbreaking legal work, you'll hear about these cases. You'll hear about high school senior Aaron Frick fighting for his right to attend prom with his boyfriend, about access to health care for people living with HIV and AIDS, about parents' rights to adopt their kids, and their right to marry each other. And you'll hear about how GLAAD, in each case, has helped move forward the fight for equal justice under law.
Thank you for listening to this GLAAD 30th Anniversary podcast, and special thanks to the History Project for use of archival material. Visit glaad.org to learn more about this story and to download a new podcast on the 15th of every month.